Welcome back to the Color Authority. I hope you all had an amazing summer. I sure did. And I hope you're all ready for season two. It's going to be a little bit different from season one because, you know, along the way we learn, right? So I'm going to be launching every Tuesday and I'm going to be launching new episodes every other week. Now, this season, I'm also going to amplify a little bit the people I'm going to be talking to. In the first season, I talked a lot to color experts directly inherent to my job as a color consultant, as a trend forecaster and a color forecaster. But for the next season, I'm going to be talking a lot to people who are working with color directly or indirectly on a daily basis in, let's say, a broader market, a larger sector. Not necessarily are they all color experts. They do work in design and they definitely are creative. So stay tuned and here comes my next episode. Hey everyone, this is Judith from the Color Authority, podcasting out of Milan, Italy. I could not think of a better person to interview for my second season, my first episode of The Color Authority, than Leatrice Eisman. She's director of the Eisman Center for Color Information and Training and executive director of the Pantone Color Institute. Lee is a professional color specialist who often is called the International Color Guru. Her color expertise is recognized worldwide, particularly as executive director of, indeed, the Pantone Color Institute. Lee has been widely quoted in many publications and is recognized by Fortune magazine and the Wall Street Journal as one of the most influential people in the world of color. She's the author of 10 books on color, and today she's available as a corporate color consultant and a sought-after speaker. She also offers online courses on color theory and personal image color training. I met Lee during one of these summits in the United States at Color Marketing Group, and finally, I get to talk to her today. Welcome, Leatrice Eisman, to the Color Authority. I'm super excited to have you here on my talk. How are you today?
I'm good. I'm very good. Thank you.
Lee, I ask all of my guests on the podcast the same question. So obviously, I'm also going to ask this to the guru of color. What is color to you?
Oh my goodness. What is color to me? I can't imagine my life without being as involved with color as I've been. But, you know, your first answer, your knee-jerk reaction is it's everything. But of course, it can't be everything in your life. But it certainly has been an enhancement that started very early in my life, in my childhood. And I cannot imagine my life without being involved in some way with working with color, enjoying color, using color, being absorbed with color. It's that important to me.
I would imagine you had a very interesting path to the world of color that may inspire many color enthusiasts that are looking into being part of our world of color professionals. What was your path to color? Where did it all start?
It started when I was a child. I was fortunate to have a mother and an aunt who were very influential in my life with color, in that they believed that a child should be allowed to do whatever they want with color. So whenever I wanted color in my room or I wanted to change it, if I colored outside the lines, they encouraged that. I mean, it was the kind of upbringing that with these two women in my life, my aunt and my mother, with their encouragement, they recognized that I had skill with color as a child. And they would ask my advice when I got a little bit older. When I say older, you know, maybe 10 years old, what color do you think we should use in the living room? You know, do you think this is a good color or that's a good color? Do you like the color of this dress? They recognized my ability and they would come to me for advice. So that kind of early nurturing had a huge effect on me.
I can imagine that. I think your upbringing just in general and how people, and especially your parents, but also possibly teachers in school, would help you to tap into your creative selves. And I think in that perspective, you have been very lucky. How many times did you repaint your room?
Many, many times. But the proviso was I got to change the color as many times as I wanted, but I had to do the grunt work. So I did the painting and I did the changing, so that it also taught me a sense of responsibility. I can make this change, but I also have to make it happen. Nobody's going to do it for me. It's not going to magically appear. So the exercise of changing the color and putting it together and experimenting and painting things different colors, you know, my desk or the bedposts or whatever was available, not only the walls. So that was really a good practice session for me. But I would say in my years of growing up, by the time I left the house in my early 20s, I probably changed the color maybe 10 or 15 times.
Yeah, that's it sounds like a lot of work, but it sounds like a lot of excitement in the house as well for you and your family.
Yes.
So after you left the house, you went to study. How did you then incorporate color in your daily life? And how do you still do so each and every day now?
Well, I didn't start out with the intention of becoming a colorist because I wasn't an artist. And there weren't too many avenues that were open to people who were into color, except for fashion. Obviously, everybody knew that if you were in the fashion field, you had to know something about color. And I was in retail for a while. I was in personnel, human resources. I did various things when I was a teenager, still in school, working on the weekends that involved the use of color in fashion. And that's always good training ground, I think, for a young person. Then when I went to college, I was given the opportunity to go work for a finishing school where, of course, color was important, and I started out as a receptionist on my off hours from my college classes. And one night, a teacher didn't show up, and the director of the school said, "You go in and teach the class." Of course, I was scared half to death, but I loved the idea of teaching, and I was bitten at that point. And one of the areas that we had to study in that school was color. And so that was really the start of my interest in color. And then when I went on in later years to graduate from school and get my degrees, I was able then to incorporate color into my degree structure. I was allowed to do a practicum around color at UCLA, which was a huge, huge advantage and help in the psychology of color.
I can imagine that. And that's how you tapped into your passion. And that's how you probably now became, although you're not even using that title yourself, probably, but the international guru of color, of course. But you have trained and taught so many professionals globally, and you continue to do so because I think that's one of your passions. How important is this connecting with all these creatives around the world, and what do you, Lee, what do you get out of it?
Well, you get an enormous out of it. As a teacher at heart, there is something about sharing your knowledge with others that is just so rewarding to me, particularly when you come together with people who have this passion for color, mm-hmm. because obviously anybody who seeks training with me has the passion to begin with. They have the motivation. And that's a big deal. The motivation, it's a word I use all the time. They made it happen. They came to me for training. They go online and find me. I love motivated people. And having that connection with them, it's like having kindred spirits. You know that these people have the same love and passion and appreciations that you do. And you get back from that. So you're giving knowledge, the knowledge that you've accrued over the years. You're giving that back to others, but at the same time, you are receiving, you are learning from them. So it is absolutely, it's a two-way street. And it's probably the most enjoyable thing that I do.
Yeah. I think we met for the first time, obviously, in one of the meetings in the International Summit of Color Marketing Group. And I remember you speaking. And I remember that we talked a little bit back in San Diego as well. And then in Philly, I do think that indeed connecting the way we do also at Color Marketing Group with people who are passionate about color, there's this warmth that you feel when you come to these meetings of Color Marketing Group, because we speak the same language. We have that same love and passion for color. And I think that those are very special moments. So yeah, I agree with the education part that you are doing. I'm trying to also do that with the podcast to bring out more knowledge and information about color, because I do think there's still a lot to be done with regards to the topic. You know, you never stop learning with regards to color and connecting to people within the application of color either.
Right. I think that's one of the most fascinating things about color. It's not a subject that you say, okay, I'm really smart now. I've learned it all. You know, of course, it should be that way with anything. But I think with color in particular, you tap into your own natural resources, but then you observe what others are doing and you adapt and you get to talk about it. You know, you mentioned Color Marketing Group, which has been hugely influential in my life, in that I'm probably the dinosaur that still comes to Color Marketing Group. It's been years and years and years. The connections that I have made, starting back with my first book, have been so important to me. Because as you say, you're with kindred spirits, you're with people who have the same love and understanding that you do. They all come together. You get to share and connect with each other. It's like teaching the class. It's a slightly different level. And it's absolutely fascinating. It's been so important in my professional life.
Yes, and I do think that when you come to these meetings of Color Marketing Group, that's like, it's my moment in the year as well. So I get to see everybody again. I get to see the tribe. I get to receive so much information with regards to colors, to color trends, with the color education that's going on, but even just connecting with the people. And you just mentioned a very interesting word, which is your natural resources. So it's really what we all have within. Some call it natural resources. I sometimes call it intuition. I talked about intuition with a few guests and past episodes, and I believe this is crucial in life, but also when you work in color. How do you use your intuition? And moreover, how do you teach your students to become aware of theirs?
Well, you know, that's a very interesting question, Judith, because I think that sometimes people are seeking the absolute truths. You know, give me the rule book and tell me what is acceptable and not acceptable. And with color, you can't make it that dogmatic. You, of course, there are guidelines, and I use the word guidelines. I rarely use the word rule when it comes to color, because things that we used to think of as color rules seem so outdated now. I mean, I can remember as a child being told that blue and green should never be seen. In other words, you didn't use it as a combination. The area that I lived in, the eastern coast of the United States, they were very, very traditional about their use of color. And even as a child, I questioned that. Blue and green should never be seen? What about the beautiful vista of a blue sky and a green rolling meadow below it? I mean, can you make anything more beautiful than what occurs in nature? So I always questioned those rules as I was growing up. And so I tell my students, the people that I work with, my clients, don't think so much in color rules. Rules can be broken. Guidelines are a better way to proceed. And this is the way that I look at it. And I would tell anybody that asks me that voice within inside of you, what makes you interested in color and that you know you have this ability to begin with, don't discard that. Get rid of those notions that there is some rule book in the sky that is going to tell you exactly how you use color. Of course, there's the color wheel. There are the standard ways of learning about color. But there's also the tweaking and the intuition that you mentioned. Go back to what's inside of you. Sometimes, I mean, we've all had this happen. You make a decision about something, and then you start to doubt your decision. Oh, is that the right combination to use? You know, and then somehow you wind up circuitously going back to where you began, because that was your intuition telling you that was the right choice. What I try to do is help you guide your intuition and give you the rationale for the choice. So there's not your, oh, I like it. I love those colors together. You have to have the reasons for making it happen, the rationale.
Yeah. It can't just be, it feels good. Although maybe that's what your intuition initially said. I have that when I pick out colors. Sometimes when I'm already with the client at the table, I'm already visioning them. I'm like, okay, I already know this blue and that green, and I think I'll add a yellow to that. And I already know it. But at that moment, if I would tell the client, I can't explain it yet because that's just my inner voice. Then after, obviously, you have to back that up. And I think with color, that is super important, right? The storytelling and making people understand why you pick those colors, but also for that market, that consumer, and maybe also why that year, why that moment, because colors are around all the time, right? But they flow according to what we feel, what's happening out there, they move.
Right, exactly.
So you are also a color therapist, which is a title that I read that you are. And it's super interesting to me. And it's intriguing, I think, because it taps into color psychology and how some colors make some people feel very well and yet others not so much. How do you work in these cases? And how, why is it that there's some colors that just really don't do it for us?
Well, you know, there are some general precepts about color. I mean, if you travel around the world, and I've done word association studies, color word association studies for a long time now, and they can change over the years, by the way, depending on recent events and trends and so on. But for the most part, there are certain symbolic meanings often attached to nature that if you go to most countries all over the world and you show a dot of yellow and you ask people to have their first response, invariably sunshine is going to be in that response somewhere. It's such an inherently understood concept, the warmth of the sun. But then what enters into it is your individual connotation of the color. Did you eat too much yellow popcorn when you were a child and you got sick at the carnival and you couldn't stand that color, you know, yellow any longer because it made you ill? So there are the general precepts that we learn about, some of them based on culture, some of them based on geography, where you're living, lots of reasons for them, but also there's the individual reaction to color. And it's kind of an amalgamation of all of those things. It goes into an understanding as to how you then use color therapy. You use the word therapy because it is therapeutic. I mean, there's no question that we've all had the experience of walking into a room and instantly feeling an attachment to that environment. Oh my goodness, this, I could live in this room. Or you look at a picture in a decorating magazine online. And you say, oh, it just draws you in. It speaks to you. Now, the fun part is to find out why it speaks to you. Why does it say what it's saying? And that's the therapy part. Digging into your background, often your childhood, some things that are long submerged in your psyche that you don't even overtly remember, and yet they are still there in that recording bank, in your memory bank. So my work encompasses all that general knowledge, but an associational knowledge. But in addition to that, the personal proclivities to color need to come into play as well.
So you connect with people on a level that is very intimate. It's very emotional. And I feel that this is a big part of also who you are and how you like to connect with other people. Mm-hmm. But that must also be, indeed, the intimacy sometimes, that must be also be exhausting, or how do you feel when you are connected with people as the color therapist in you?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question. It's exhausting only if you're working with a client who has this deep dislike of a particular color. Mm-hmm. And you know that that's the perfect color for the widget that they're designing. And you know it for many reasons, you know, all the professional reasons that it's going to sell well, the competition hasn't thought about using that color, all of the things that you think about. But as far as he or she is concerned, not purple. Okay, as an example. So my challenge is to find out why they feel the way they do about purple and see what I can do, perhaps to change their mind, to try to understand where they're coming from, where that dislike of the color emerged, and perhaps convince them. But there are times that you cannot convince. And I think that's the exhausting part, where you have to kind of pedal back and know that even though you're giving them your best advice, that color's not going to happen. But at least you're honest with them and telling them, this is what I think is best. Let's try to get to the reasons why you dislike the color. And that's the fascinating part.
Yeah, I can imagine. And I think also there's a lot of people that just generally, they have resistance. Just resistant, obviously, if you're going to ask questions about the why, possibly, indeed, that means they have to go deeper into themselves or in their past. And not everybody obviously is keen on doing that, especially not if they're, for their sake, talking about color. You know, for them, it's color for a product, but they have no clue how a color can make them feel, and also how that could influence indeed their customers and their consumers in the end. So it's interesting how you work in that way, and how you can, you know, take them a little bit by the hand and follow them through that path of color exploration, let's call it that way as well. So you talked in your late interview also about color negatives. How can you eliminate those? So not really about maybe this customer of yours that doesn't want purple, but maybe just in generally, are there misperceptions or are there color negatives that still exist today?
Yes, unfortunately there are. And, you know, in the years that I started in color, a lot of my research was done at university libraries or big city libraries, because they had what were called color abstracts, which still exist. But I would have to go to the library and pore through the books and find the studies in a very tedious way. And then, of course, with the computer taking place, and now we can go online and find anything we want. But the problem is, and I tell my students this all the time, you see things that are passed around that are urban legends that are not based in fact. But if something is repeated enough times, then people start to believe it, and then they pass that information on to others. That's a big frustration of mine. So online has been a wonderful resource for us. We can Google anything we want to, but on the other hand, we have to check our resources. And I think that is one of the most important things to learn, is what are the urban legends, what is true, what is false. And I think for a professional, that is really, really important to look into, not to just adapt it because you've seen it online. It may not be true. And I think that's one of the big challenges today. There's a lot out there. I'll give you an example. Don't paint babies' rooms yellow because babies will cry more in yellow rooms. When I first heard that, and you still see it, you still see it being passed around online, I was determined to research it. I found out what the source was. I understood that this person who started this rumor, which is what it started, was quite a showman. He disliked the color yellow, but he was widely quoted and people believed it because he said it, but it was his personal dislike. There were no studies that equivocated that babies will cry more in yellow rooms. It just doesn't happen, but still you see it online. So that's an example of what I mean, of what can be passed on that is absolutely untrue. And it's up to a professional to do enough research or to go to a credible resource and find out what's true and what's false.
That can be frustrating, right? I read some things about color psychology as well, about color and color use. And how people are indeed, there's this copy-pasting industry, right? Especially in the digital world. And I think it's beautiful that everybody is enjoying color. I have the feeling that's more and more often. More people are using color. There are more people calling themselves color experts, color professionals. But it is a dangerous place, the internet, to find information, to filter information about anything. Doesn't matter what topic you're talking about. But indeed, the yellow for babies and crying, that's a relation. And then coming from somebody who just had his own personal misperception about yellow, that's just something that I can imagine that if you follow that as a professional, that can be quite dangerous even in your field and how to be taken serious. How... Yes. What are those urban legends? What is the advice to people that are listening? Where should they go and look into the history of color and where, let's call it, the truth of color psychology?
Well, I think you have to go to a reputable resource for one thing, someone who has been involved in color psychology for a long time, someone who has really studied it deeply. And the other thing is that if you're going to do it on your own, it's important to, if you were, you know, researching a particular color usage, would be, what is your resource? Did it come from a university source? How many studies were done? Were these all 18 and 19 year olds? Was there a mix of ages? You just can't take a study and assume that that's going to be the definitive study, because you have to look at the demographics, you have to look at everything around it. And if you look at enough studies, then you can start to see that there is a pattern that does show that this is the reaction. But you should never take it from just one resource, or you go to someone who is a repository of those resources and has the experience. And you're right, Judith, there are people who, you know, have an eye for color and like color. And so they become a color specialist, a color consultant. But if you're really serious about your work, you really have to delve more deeply into it and really take the time to do some research. It's more than just, I like the color, as you mentioned earlier.
Yeah.
And I think that's a very naive way of looking at it. But I think people who are really serious about color understand that the educational part, the research part, is really very important.
Yeah. When I work in color, I've been working in color for 15 years, a little bit longer than that. It is something that I've always separated, but I've seen people around me that are maybe not as deep in color that take color personal. And they would say, I don't like that color, so I'm not putting in the palette. But it's important to know what color is coming, where color is moving. And maybe you do not like darker ochre yellows. But if you know they're coming, it's so important when you do trend research, for example. And that's still, I think, just like you said, it's not just about research, it's about researching well, but also not getting your personal opinion, getting that in the way when you work with color.
Yes, exactly.
How do you personally connect with color on a daily basis? Do you have rituals?
That's an interesting question. I don't know that I regard it as rituals, but I think it's important to pay attention to the mundane things in life. You know, I can say if I'm in a big city, I love to go to the museums. I love to look at the work of art. I love to look at the architecture. I mean, all of those things are important. And of course, if you're into color, you do that. But I think it's taking advantage of the things around us on a daily basis that we just sort of take for granted. I just moved to a very different area than the area I've lived in for many years. I moved from the Northwest to the Southwest. And I have previous experience in having lived in California. So I know what the climate is like. Much different here, desert colors around me, cacti and succulent, that a whole different structure of plant life. The surprise of some of the color combinations that you see in a saguaro cactus on the one day that they come to bloom, and you look at the colors and you say, that is so amazing. I can't imagine that. I hadn't even thought about using those colors together. Of taking those things on a walk, you know, the colors that you see in the fallen leaves on the floor of the forest when you're walking, a new kind of way of putting colors together that keeps your awareness going, keeps you open to new ideas and new concepts. So it goes beyond museums and magazines and trade publications. They're all important, of course, but it is, again, I will use that word, mundane. Taking advantage of the world around us and really studying the way, particularly, they've been used in nature and receiving nurturance from those everyday things.
Yeah. I think the desert in Tucson in Arizona, which I was lucky enough to visit, you know, coming from a small country in Europe and then living in Italy. Today, funny enough that I'm interviewing you, I put on my color stories on my Instagram, I've put two of the cacti and some color combinations that I had seen, and I didn't connect it, but it's funny that I put those out because I was connecting somehow today with Tucson. Now that you're saying that this is where you moved, it's funny. Mm-hmm. And I do remember that those are colors that are given to you each and every day. And that is a blessing. It's a gift to be living in such a beautiful place. And we are sometimes not aware of it. We just go quick. We're on the move. We're stressed. We're going to a work. But it's nature that connects us in the end.
Yes, absolutely.
I came across the topic of color and well-being. We tapped on it a little bit earlier. It's more and more often I see articles about it. I see that there's an interest, and I do think COVID-19 has had its effect on how we are talking about well-being and how color could help us. It's a very hot topic. What are your thoughts on this, and where do you think this possibly could move in the future?
Well, of course, with having been sequestered, all of us, for a long time, people have reacted in polar opposites. Either they feel more secure in their home because at least this is a place of safety when they were at home, and with their families, a feeling of closeness. So the colors in the world around them became the most comforting colors, and they feel very secure in that. On the other hand, being sequestered for some people, not everyone, but for some, means I cannot stand the color of these walls anymore. I need to do something different. I need to change my environment to at least, I can't move, but at least I can change the colors around me. So there have been two extremes in the way that people have reacted. I think it's dangerous to overgeneralize and say everybody is reacting this way because of those two extremes. And I think what you have to do as a professional, if you were advising someone, is to find out intrinsically how they feel, you know, what is the outcome of this experience that we've just gone through and are still going through, and how we can then relate that to the individual and make them feel uplifted. Now, I find that for those who are thinking more in terms of serenity, tranquility, quiet, that's what they want, then obviously the colors that you would choose would be colors that would speak to that particular area of tranquility and serenity. Perhaps the cool greens, the blue greens, the lavenders to the cool side. But at the same time, if you really examine it, they might say, okay, this is tranquil. But there is also a premise that I teach in my classes called homeostasis, which means we're always trying to keep ourselves in balance. And if you had a completely cool, tranquilizing, serene background, that can get a little boring. I mean, the human mind is, you know, attached to the fact that I need something to balance that coolness. So you have to bring in a touch of warmth somewhere, and that's where your homeostasis kicks in. So I know that's a long-winded answer to your question, but again, it depends on the individual and how they are responding rather than giving a general answer. And so it's important to figure out what has made them feel more secure or perhaps less secure and more bored with what they have around them because they've been sequestered.
And that comes back to what you said earlier. It's the connecting with your clients. You know, it's just about the statistics. Like sometimes I have clients like, okay, looking for this, like a water boiler. UK is the market. Age 18, 40. I mean, those are the stats. That's great to know. That's what you need to know for it to pick out a color. But then it's always good to connect with those who are indeed producing, but also who are in the end, consumers and how they have lived in the past days or weeks before you actually get to pick up a color. So it's interesting how you connect with people also on that emotional level.
Right, exactly. And of course, when you're dealing with a broad consumer level, obviously you don't get to talk to every single person who's going to be buying the product, but you have to arrive at some kind of a place in the middle that says to you, okay, so now I know we have to have some balance in this line that we're presenting. If we do it all in cool, tranquilizing colors, and we're leaving out some of that homeostasis factor in the warmth, then I'm going to miss some of the consumers that are going to be leaning to that side. So you have to learn how to coordinate all of these emotional aspects, bring them together by the colors and with the colors that you're using.
So the color harmonization within, you know, to reach a wider target is definitely something that you are teaching your students. How important is storytelling in color trends, and how do you connect the two? So what is your methodology when you work in colors? How do you personally go and collect your main inspirations for your work?
Well, I think that with the color of the year, for example, what we do is try to arrive at, again, the symbolic meaning behind the colors is very, very important. Again, it's not just a question of, oh, we haven't done this color before. Isn't this a hot color? You know, isn't this a great color? It's got to be more thoughtful than that. And I think that's what people have really, really responded to is the reasoning behind it with the yellow and the gray for this year. Yellow, because it is the color of sunlight universally. It is warmth. It is cheer. In our word association studies, this is how people respond to the meaning of yellow. And certainly we're at a time now where this is what we need. We need to be uplifted. So we felt that the yellow did that, gave us hope. Yellow is a color of hope. But in addition to that, we needed a grounded feeling. We needed something firm and solid. At least this was in our best judgment. the color of granite and rock and stone, of those things that are in the world around us that are, that present stability. And so putting those two colors together created that that feeling of connection. And yet they're colors that can stand very well on their own. But by bringing them together, we felt that that really reflected both sides of the spectrum, the warmth and the groundedness coming together.
And there's the balance again, the balance between those two forces. So you already talked a little bit about the fact that you indeed still are working also executive director of the Pantone Color Institute. What more do you do for Pantone? Because I imagine you're not only doing the color of the year, there it goes a lot further now, doesn't it?
Yes, yes. Well, I'm a prime consultant to Pantone and have been for a long time. Yes. I'm the executive director of the Pantone Color Institute, and I wear many hats, you know, not only that, but I also have my own consulting service. But for Pantone, what I have done is to be a sounding board, to present color trends to them, forecast directions. I do a home forecast. I also participate in a viewpoint of David Shaw's group and have for many years contributed to that. I've been a spokesperson for them. I've written books for them. So it's been a happy marriage over the years of going back to the originator of the Pantone system, Larry Herbert, who was presented with my first book. Mm-hmm. And he called me. I was living in Hollywood at the time. My husband was in the music business and worked for 20th Century Fox at that point. And Larry called me and he said, someone gave me your book and we are thinking of starting a color institute because people are calling Pantone all the time and asking questions about the psychology of color. And we don't have a clue. I mean, we're the technical guys. We're not the touchy-feely guys. We need the touchy-feely person. And so we went to lunch together. We had some mutual acquaintances and that helped at the same time. And I met a man who had worked for Pantone at Color Marketing Group. So it was just kind of like a convergence of all of these things, you know, sort of serendipitous that we came together at the same time. And it's been a happy marriage since then.
And it's been very natural. You know, it was a very natural connection as what I hear from your story. And it's lovely that you could still, you know, you get to be part of this beautiful organization, but then still get to do your own thing for your own color consultancy, which I think for a person of your status is so important.
Yes. And by the way, one of the things that I say to my students is don't put all of your eggs in one basket. Diversification is important in these days. And so you need to have something else that you can refer to that speaks to yourself, that is an expression of you. Yep. And I think that's really important.
That's exactly what happened to me earlier this year. I'm not sure if it's me hitting the 40 or if it's COVID or whatever it was, but certainly I just felt restrained and I couldn't indeed follow those passions that I had and those ideas and those inspirations that I had. I couldn't follow them through. And then I was just, listening to this part here. The intuition and happy ever since.
Good for you.
So you have an impressive list of books. You just said that indeed, I mean, 10 books, if I'm correct. And that's a lot of books that you've been written over the past for indeed, for yourself, for Pantone. And as we already said early in the conversation, I feel you can never know enough about color. Do you have any future plans of writing more? Or is there anything else that you may want to reveal to the listeners? Maybe there is a project that you're working on?
Well, there's always a book in the works in my head. If there were only enough hours in the day to get it all done, that's it. So I've got several ideas that are ruminating. One very important one, I think, though, that is really going to be my next project, is all about a group of colors I call the crossover colors. We've talked about color in nature. Mm-hmm. I think that that's very important to pay attention to. It was a concept that I started with my first book called The Color Clock, and I put colors into different color times. And it's a color theory based on warm, cool, and neutral colors. And it started out with the fashion field and in cosmetics and clothing and so on. But the further I got into it, the more I realized that this concept of the crossover colors could also work, and the color clock, in interior environments as well, in product environments. So I want to take it that next step to show people how you can take this color clock concept and adapt it to other areas, not just for personal use, but also for more industrial use, if you will have it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that sounds very interesting. I never thought about the color of the crossover with the words per se. I never thought of it in that perspective, but I do think that is another additional help to those who are out there working as color design professionals to decorate or do, especially in architecture. What I've seen, especially in the architecture field world, they have to pick up colors for a much longer time than for interior home design, of course.
Right.
It gets a little bit tricky to pick out those colors that have, let's say, more longevity as well, in urban areas especially.
And there are approximately 20 colors that fit into that category that would become the crossover colors. The human eye is so accustomed to seeing these colors that they fit well into many different kinds of palettes. But I think it needs more explanation so that people understand where that came from, what's involved. And so it's becoming part of my online training as well as a new book. So working on both of those at the same time.
Interesting. I'm sure that after people are listening to this podcast, there's going to be a lot of people that are going to want that training and probably also going to buy that book of yours. Yes. I think indeed the why behind things is becoming more and more important. People need to understand life more. That's probably also due to the current happenings. But it's good, I think, that you will be able to explain why those 20 colors, for example, came about and why they feel so inherent to us human beings and why we are so used to them. So many people in the world of color, but also beyond, I'm sure, they look up to you. I'm one of those persons, and I'm sure that you connect with many of these on a daily basis. But this is, I guess it gives you also certain responsibility. And that's normally responsibility gives pros and cons, right? And it's the pros and cons of your family. And I must say, you are very warm. You're a very accessible person, very pleasant to speak with. But how do you handle this fame sometimes? And how has it influenced you to become who you are today?
You know, that is such a good question, because we all have days when I don't want to hear another thing. Don't even talk to me about, color. I just want to, go away and chill out. But what I have found is that when people have that need to discuss color and they come to you, it is such an inherent feeling. It's very hard when you have that connection to others. And you've been trained, as I have, to have that affinity and empathy for others, that can overrule those bad days. And you find by being a sounding board for others that it helps you to realize, I'm in a great place. I'm not in such a bad place, when you talk to someone else who is coming to you with something that might reveal something very important to them. And so you give back. When you give back, you are going to keep receiving. And so I think that positive reaction, if you can stay ahead of it, I mean, this move has been crazy making for me. I mean, taking a house that I lived in an office for 24 years and totally turning it upside down. But at the same time, there's a sense of renewal. And I think when you get new questions and people have needs, it opens you up to the fact that, yes, you can change, you can roll with it. And you've weathered the experience, and now you can share that with someone else. And there's a great reward in that.
Yeah, and changes are only constant. So that's going to continue to happen. And I think also for people like ourselves, we are creatives. We need that change, because yes, things cannot stay stagnant, because we'll get bored, but also our inspiration will slowly die. And that with that, probably our creativity will do as well, indeed.
Absolutely.
What we do see, and we see this a lot on social media, is that fame, everybody wants to be famous. Everybody wants to be great at stuff, but they're not really ready always to put the work in, right? I mean, I'm sure that you've seen that as well. What is a possible lesson for, let's say, the younger people that are listening? Should they want to become, let's say, the next Lee out there? What are very, really crucial lessons that you would like to give them?
Well, I think, of course, continuing your education is really very important. Unfortunately, most of the colleges and universities will teach color theory and other peripheral classes, but it doesn't get as deeply into color psychology as they could, unless you are fortunate enough to go to a school that has a teacher or teachers who are very interested in the subject. So seek out as many books, as many mentors, you know, as much as you can. I think that joining a group like Color Marketing Group is very important. Of course, you want to have some degree of professionalism at the same time in a group. But I think there is room for the students in a group like that, perhaps a separate unit that can offer that to students to come join us and learn from us. I think there's a possibility there. Networking with people who have similar likes and dislikes, including color, who have that passion for it. And again, paying attention to that voice inside of you, not being so intimidated by what the experts out there say, you know, and not listening to the voice inside of you that tells you, if you were an artist and you were drawing some beautiful painting, I'm sure Monet never stopped to say, well, you know, if Gauguin didn't like this color combination, maybe I shouldn't use it because it's not one of his favorite color combinations. It came from Monet. It came from his hands, his heart, his brain. And I think you have to pay attention to what comes out of you instinctively that draws you to color in the first place.
Yeah, listening to that inner voice, your instinct, which are, I think, skills, emotional skills that a lot of people have lost a little bit along the way. But I do feel that people are returning to that. So I think that's, it's going to be very helpful for us who are working in creative and in color. Mm-hmm. You have created quite the legacy for yourself and all those people that you touched with your work. But do you still have a dream? Besides the book that we just talked about and, you know, coming up with a new training, what is something that you would like to people remember you like? Or besides everything that you've done, what do you dream about still?
Oh, that's such a good question. Because my life is so involved with my work that, you know, the two are so intertwined. It's hard for me to think of a goal without thinking of the work that I do. I think my ultimate goal is to have to be able to leave some kind of legacy that that people will find useful. And to be able to communicate with more people, to continue down that path of reaching out and being able to touch people and have them reach back. I think if you can stay on that path, you're going to continue to be nurtured and nurturing others at the same time. I can't say that I have a goal beyond that other than, well, maybe one of my goals too, is that when a woman reaches a certain age, yeah, this is important. When a woman reaches a certain age, that you feel that you still are viable, that your knowledge is important. And I think in societies that, you know, value a lot of youthfulness, and I am all for that. I mean, that's what helps to keep you young. But I think understanding that there is this fountain of knowledge, and as people get older, they have this wisdom that they can impart to you. And I think one of my jobs is to show others that women of a certain age, as they grow in age, have a lot to contribute. And so we need to reach out, understand that, and value it. And I'm seeing that happen right now. And I think it's wonderful. And that is that's a cause that I'm dedicated to get that message out there.
Oh, amen. I mean, finally, indeed, the world is doing this. I feel obviously as a woman, I only can feel connected with this, and I can only thank you as being one of those persons that I look up to, but a lot of people look up to. And I think with that last answer of yours, I don't even want to ask anything anymore, because that was just a beautiful ending to my talk to you, Lee. Thank you so much for sharing your wisdom once again and for being part of the Color Authority.
Thank you, Judith, for giving me the opportunity to share.
So this was Judith Van Vliet from the Color Authority. Thank you for listening again to yet another episode. If you haven't done so, please go to Apple Podcasts, subscribe, review, and send us feedback on this episode. And I hope that you will be listening to the next episode coming out very, very soon. Thank you, and have an amazing, colorful day.